Okay, so today is effectively the last lecture of the course. In fact, at the end of today's lecture, I'm actually going to start reviewing a little bit. What I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to rehash what I discussed on Friday, how we decompose a vector. First of all, a component of a vector that's running parallel to another vector. And second of all, how you decompose a vector, finding a piece of a vector that actually lives inside a subspace. So I'll review those constructions, and then I'll do two examples of that so you see explicitly how you calculate. And then what we'll do is we'll begin our review. What I'm going to talk about at the end of lecture today is just row reduction and how many different ways we use row reduction in this course. Okay, and then on Wednesday and Friday this week, well, I'll do a more substantial review, probably go over a practice sample exam, etc. Okay, so what I talked about on Friday last week is to work. There we go. Okay, so last week I was talking about given two vectors, say a vector A and a vector B, how do I find the component of a vector A that's running parallel to B and another piece of A that's running perpendicular to P? Now, in this picture, it's kind of clear that basically what you need is some plane geometry, some little trigonometry, and you ought to be able to figure out these components. For example, at least the length of this vector here is going to be, well, you apply a Pythagoras' theorem and a little trigonometry. The length of the adjacent side of a right triangle, side adjacent to the angle, is the length of the hypotenuse times the cosine of the angle between the two vectors. And what we actually use in linear algebra, though, is not this geometric picture where we think of vectors as being directed line segments. Rather, what we use is the dot product, which allows us to extract geometric information from the vectors as they're typically presented in this course. So in this course, a vector inside an n-dimensional vector space is just a list of numbers, say v1 through vn. And the way we extract geometric information about these ordered lists of numbers is we use the dot product. So A dot B is going to be the first component of A times the first component of B plus the second component of A times the second component of B, etc., until we've exhausted all the components. So we can compute this, but what makes it useful to our intuition is the fact we have another formula for this dot product that's purely geometric. You take the length of A, you take the length of B, and you multiply by that the cosine of the angle between the vectors A and B, and you get a geometric version of the same dot product. Now, what we'll do is we'll compute the dot product using ordered lists of numbers, but we'll use on the left-hand side here to interpret that dot product geometrically. From this formula here, we see that the length of A is just equal to the square root of the dot product of A with itself, and that the cosine between two vectors is just equal to their dot product divided by their lengths, but the lengths can also be computed using this formula for the dot product, B dot B. And so what I did at the start of Friday's lecture is I took this geometric picture, and then I tried to compute these various subvectors, this component of A that lies in the direction of B and this perpendicular component. I use trigonometry to compute those, but those angles and those lengths are not going to be computed by using rulers and protractors as I would do for this figure. Rather, I use the linear algebraic dot product, this expansion, to compute those. But in the end, what happened though is that my final answer, while computable using dot products for n-dimensional vectors, is fairly simple. This formula for the component of A that's going in parallel to B, that's simply the dot product of A with B divided by effectively the magnitude squared of B times the vector B. So this is a scalar factor, so just a number times a vector that will produce a vector. All right, so that business was pretty easy. Basically, the derivation of these formulas basically came from this. We just need to how to get the geometric information from the dot product and then apply that to get these two components. The main problem, though, I wanted to discuss on Friday was more general. Instead of finding the part of a vector B that is running parallel to a given vector, I want to find the part of a vector B that lives inside a subspace W. So here the picture is more like this. So this flat surface here, that's our subspace. Think of this as embedded in a three-dimensional space, and I have a two-dimensional subspace, and I have a one-dimensional vector sitting inside as well. The idea of an orthogonal decomposition with respect to a subspace is you try to find the component of your vector V that actually lives inside the subspace, and a separate component that's actually perpendicular to that subspace. Okay, now, to be perpendicular to a subspace, what does that actually mean? You're not perpendicular to the individual vectors in that subspace. You're perpendicular to the lines that are in that subspace. And so that makes it a little bit difficult. And these sort of considerations that we use on the preceding slide, where we just looked for the components of a vector with respect to a vector, then the simple geometry was sufficient. To solve this problem, as I did on Friday, really requires a lot of apparatus from more complicated linear algebra. We're going to have to introduce another subspace, and we're going to have to find bases for these subspaces. We're going to have to expand the vector V with respect to a particular basis. So I'll go through that again, but the one thing you should note before I even start is that all the technique I solved for this problem, even though it appears to be just a higher dimensional generalization of the first problem, where I only want to decompose a vector with respect to another vector. Here, when I decompose it with respect to a subspace, we need more formal apparatus of the entire course, not just this geometric interpretation of the dot product. Okay, but the idea is similar to what we did before. We take an arbitrary vector V, and we want to break it up into a piece that lives inside the subspace and a separate piece. And we get back the original vector by combining those two constituents. All right, and the way we do that is we introduce an auxiliary subspace. The subspace W subscript perp is the set of all vectors in the entire vector space that's perpendicular to every vector inside W. All right, so here's how we do it. First of all, I'm assuming that we've got this, we've found this a subspace, and we've even gone as far as calculating a basis for it. Then what I do is I create this secondary subspace. It's going to consist of all the vectors in the entire vector space that are perpendicular to every vector inside the given subspace. Now that condition, if I leave it this way, it's kind of hard to figure out how I'm going to find all these vectors. But in fact, what I showed you on Friday was that if B subscript W, and let me just list a set of vectors through BK, if this is a basis for your subspace W, then every W inside W has a unique expression as W equals C1 B1 plus dot dot plus CK BK. To have a basis means you have enough directions to reach every point in your subspace using a unique expression of this form. Now, if I want W, so suppose B lives in this perpendicular subspace. Then what I want, it's got to be, this B has got to be perpendicular to every vector, including this guy. Should be perpendicular to every vector of this form. So I need this. B is perpendicular to every vector inside W. But I can achieve that by making sure that this vector B is perpendicular to each of these basis vectors. So this is automatic if V dot BI equals zero for each basis vector. So rather than impose this condition that V is perpendicular to every vector of this form, it suffices to say that it's V is perpendicular to just these basis vectors B1 through BK. And in this condition, when you write it out, can be written as a matrix equation. Take these vectors, write them as the rows of a matrix, and then put this vector V as a column vector. Then, according to the rules of matrix multiplication, the first component of this matrix product is going to be the first row of the first factor, its dot product with the first column of the, in fact, the only column of the second factor. So that's just going to be B1 dot B in that first component. The second component is going to be exactly B2 dot V. And the last component is going to be BK dotted with V. What I want is that all these dot products of V with a basis vector to equal zero. And so I'll have 0, 0 down to 0. And now I see that, in fact, these vectors, they have to be the solutions of a homogeneous linear system where you have a coefficient matrix times a vector is equal to the zero vector. In other words, the solutions are going to be effectively the null space. So what do I mean by the solutions? What I mean to say is that the set of all vectors that are perpendicular to every vector inside W, this is going to be exactly the solution set of a linear system where the coefficient matrix is just that matrix that we form by using the original basis as rows. Okay, so that's the auxiliary subspace that we need if we're going to decompose an arbitrary vector, find out what part of it lives inside the subspace and what part lives outside the subspace. We need to construct this auxiliary subspace, but that's easy to do. We have a particular coefficient matrix. We need to find its null space, meaning we need to solve a linear system. And we do that by row reducing the coefficient matrix to row echelon form, converting back to equations, expanding the solution vector in terms of free parameters, and blah, blah, blah. In the end, you get a bunch of free parameters times column vectors, and those column vectors are exactly your basis. So in fact, we not only can calculate this subspace, we can actually find a basis for it as well. And indeed, just from this form here, I already know the dimension of that that solution set, the dimension of this null space, because each of these guys, they're basis vectors, so they're linearly independent. That means that the rows of this coefficient matrix are all linearly independent, so its rank is exactly equal to the number of rows. The dimension of the row space, since these rows are all linearly independent, it's just going to equal the number of rows. So put another way, this matrix is going to row reduce to some reduced row echelon form. When I do so, since the rows are all linearly independent, I can't get a zero row at the bottom. That means basically I'm going to have, well, I've got to have a pivot in each row, so I'm going to have k pivots. But each of these vectors is also living inside Rn. And so the number of entries in a number of columns I have is going to equal n. So upon row reduction, this is going to become a matrix where I have k non-zero rows, but I have a total of n columns. That means the number of free parameters is going to be n minus k. Right, you count the number of columns that don't have pivots to get the dimension of the solution set. So what I know about this space is, first of all, I know how to calculate it. And in fact, I already know its dimension. It's just going to be the number of rows I have minus the number of columns I have minus the number of rows. All right, so when we calculate this and we actually find the solution vectors of this linear system, what's going to turn out is that expansion of a typical solution vector is going to involve n minus k basis vectors. What I did on Friday, and I do it again today, is I'm going to count those basis vectors in a peculiar way at first. Instead of starting my basis vector and calling it basis vector number one, I'm going to call it basis vector k plus one, because the next idea is to extend this basis to a basis of n linearly independent vectors by adjoining the original k basis vectors from my subspace W, adjoining to that set of vectors the basis vectors for the solution set of this linear system. And that will be n minus k vectors. And so when I put them together, I'll go from 1 to k plus 1 to n. And I'll get a total of n linearly independent vectors. All right, so that's what we do. And now we're almost done, surprisingly. It doesn't look like we're very close to getting this decomposition. But now we use the idea of what a basis does for us again. So the first k vectors of this basis span our original subspace W. The next n minus k basis vectors, they span this perpendicular subspace, the set of all vectors that are perpendicular to every vector inside W. When I put them together, I get a basis for the entire vector space. So what I do is I take my given vector V and I try to express it in terms of this basis for Rn. So I'll have an expansion, ck plus 1, ek plus 1, dot, 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 plus cnbn. Now, what's going to happen is each of these basis vectors, b1 through bk, they live inside W. So this lies in W. The second half of the vector V, it's being expanded in terms of basis vectors for the perpendicular subspace. So that piece lives in the perpendicular subspace. So what I do is I simply call that VW, and I call this piece V perp. And that's the desired decomposition. So what remains then is to explain, how do I get these particular numbers, C1, C2, up to CN. Well, that's an old calculation that we've done. Let me recall it for you. If you want, let me put the V on this side, and let's say we have C1, B1, dot, 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 plus Cn, Bn. So I know all these basis vectors, and what I'm trying to do is figure out what coefficients I need to multiply my basis vectors by so that I can express a given vector in terms of my basis vectors. This problem, the right-hand side, can be thought as a matrix multiplication where I use as columns my basis vectors, and then it's multiplying C1 through Cn. So when you have a matrix times a column vector, that can always be expanded by using the components of the column vector, having them multiplying the corresponding, the components here multiply the columns of the coefficient matrix. And what will happen is you'll reproduce the right-hand side. And on the left-hand side, you'll have the components of the vector V. And this is a linear system where this is the unknown. It has the form of a coefficient matrix times an unknown vector is equal to a known vector. And so what do? We solve that linear system by forming the augmented matrix and row reducing to reduce row echelon form. But something nice happens in this situation because we're dealing with basis vectors. These columns are all linearly independent. So what's going to happen during this row reduction is in the end, I've got to get a matrix that has a pivot in every column. And so what in fact will happen is during this row reduction, the left-hand factor is going to row reduce to the identity matrix, and the right-hand side is going to be your solution, because the equations corresponding to this augmented matrix are x1 is equal to c1, x2 is equal to c2, x3 is equal to c3, etc. So in fact, the way you determine these coefficients is you write your given vector, you write your given vectors as the columns of a matrix. You take the vector that you're trying to express in terms of your basis vectors, you write that as the last column of an augmented matrix, and you row reduce. And then once you reach reduced row echelon form, you just look at this last column, and it's going to be exactly the coefficients you want. So you'll be able to compute all these numbers. And then to get the orthogonal decomposition, all you have to do is keep more or less the first half of that up to the last basis vector for W. You keep those terms together and you call that VW. And then the remaining terms in that expansion, they're all going to live in the perpendicular subspace. Call that contribution to the total vector V, call that V perp, and you've got your desired decomposition. Okay, so let me now work out an explicit example. So I'm going to avoid row reduction in this example, but I will go through all the steps with real numbers. I'm just explaining this on the blackboard. Let's start off with a subspace that's generated by two vectors. All possible linear combinations of the vectors 1, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 1. These are three-dimensional vectors, so what I create in that fashion is a two-dimensional subspace R3. It's pretty obvious that these two vectors are linearly independent because I can't find any linear combination of these two vectors that equal 0 without taking both coefficients equal to 0. You can see that because if I wrote C1 times B1 plus C2 times B2. Let's have that be C1 times, what is it? 1, 0, 1 plus C2 times Second one is 011. If I simply add those together, I'm going to get C1, C2, and C1 plus C2. Now, linear independence, the way you check for that is you try to solve this equation where you have a linear combination of your vectors and it produces a zero vector. And what you see as soon as you compute here is there's no way I can get a zero vector on the right-hand side without separately taking the two coefficients C1 and C2 equal to zero. And then that will also make the third component equal to zero. So the only solution of this equation is the one where the coefficients are equal to zero. That means that these two guys are linearly independent. So I saw that right away, simply because I saw there's no way I can get the first component to cancel without, because there's nothing that if I, even if I multiply this vector by a number, I can't get this piece to cancel out without making C1 is equal to zero, nor can I make this second component equal to zero by adding in some multiple of the first vector. So these guys are never going to add to the linear combination of them is never going to produce zero unless the coefficients are equal to zero. All right, so that's just arguing why this is the basis. What we're going to do in this example is figure out the component of this particular vector, 1, 4, minus 4, which we'll find out the component of this vector that lives inside W, as well as the corresponding perpendicular component. So the first step is finding a basis for W, but I've just verified that I've got a basis for W. The second step is to find this auxiliary basis, a basis for the subspace of R3 that's perpendicular to every vector inside this space. Well, that's done by constructing a matrix using these guys as rows, and then row reducing to reduced row echelon form. Well, as soon as I write this down, it's already in reduced row echelon form. So I can actually figure out the null space of this matrix. It's going to be the solutions of x1 plus 0x2 plus x3 is equal to 0. The second row is going to give me equation 0 times x1, 1 times x2 plus 1 times x3 is equal to 0. So you get these equations, and from these equations, you can extract the hyperplane solution by moving the three parameters corresponding to the columns without a pivot. You move those to the right-hand side to express the fixed variables in terms of the three parameters, and then you write down a typical solution vector. In the end, what you find is this subspace W perp, which is the set of vectors that are perpendicular to every vector in W. Every vector in this space has to be a scalar multiple of this particular vector. So that guy right there is our basis vector for W. Well, we have a basis for W, which was, these two vectors, 1, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 1. And now we've just calculated a basis for the perpendicular, which is actually the null space of the matrix I create by using these two vectors as rows. And what that turned out to be is this vector minus 1, minus 1, 1. All right, now I have a total of three basis vectors, and I can use it to expand any three-dimensional vector in terms of these three vectors. So V equals 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, and minus 1, minus 1, 1. That's now a basis, not for these individual subspaces, but for the entire vector space R3, in which both these subspaces live. All right, so we're close to the end now. We've got a basis, for the entire vector space R3, let's express this vector in terms of that basis. Well, the way we do that is we take our basis, we use those basis vectors to form the columns of a matrix, and we use the given vector as the being on the right-hand side, because what we're trying to satisfy is that C1, B1 plus C3, B3, I might as well put in the middle one, two is, that's C2, B2. What we're trying to satisfy is this equation, and effectively what we have to do is solve a linear system where the matrix I form using the basis vectors as columns times an arbitrary vector, C1, C2, C3, is equal to my given vector, which is, 1, 4, minus 4. Okay, so the augmented matrix corresponding to the linear system that I'm trying to solve is exactly this. I just took these vectors, wrote them vertically, and then I took the vector I'm trying to express in terms of this basis. I wrote it as the last column, and I row reduced to reducible echelon form. And so I see that the solution is going to be x1 is equal to minus 2, x2 is equal to 1, and x3 is equal to minus 3. So that's our solution to the problem. And now that means that V can be written as minus 2 times the first basis vector, 1 times the second basis vector, negative 3 times the third basis vector. The sum of these two vectors, well, I'm using a basis for W. So this partial sum is going to be a vector inside W. This last term, I'm using this last basis vector, which lives in the perpendicular subspace. So that's going to live outside of W. And so if I simply group the first two terms together, I get B subscript W, and the perpendicular subspace is just that last term. All right, so there's first example of how we, given a subspace, how we actually decompose an arbitrary vector, 1, 4, minus 4, into a piece that lives inside the subspace and a piece that's perpendicular to that subspace. All right, so let me do another example where the main distinction is that unlike the first example, I'm going to specify a subspace not by telling you its generators, but saying that it's the subspace corresponding to the solution set of an equation. We're still going to need a basis. So what happens in this example is the first thing I have to do is figure out a basis for the subspace under consideration. So it's defined as the solution set of a linear equation. And actually from that, let's go ahead and solve that linear system using our standard technique. We only have one equation. It's x1 plus x2 plus x3 is equal to 0. That means the augmented matrix is, 1, 1, 1. The coefficient of the first variable is 1, coefficient of the second variable is 1, coefficient of the third variable is 1, the right-hand side is equal to 0, and we only have one equation, so our augmented matrix only has one row. Well, then we would, it's already in reduced row echelon form. So once you get the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form, you write down the equations. Well, using the fact that the variables corresponding to the columns without pivots, those are going to be regarded as free parameters. So this first one and only row of this reduced row echelon form of our augmented matrix tells us that x1 has to equal minus x2 minus x3, which tells us that our solution vector x has to have the form of minus x2, minus x3, x2, x3. This is the fixed variable, and I use the equations coming from the matrix in reducible echelon form to re-express the fixed variables in terms of the free variables, and then finally we expand in terms of the free variables, get minus 1, 1, 0, plus x2 minus 1, 0, 1. And then, that's x3. So these are my basis vectors for the solution set, which is exactly my subspace. So the distinction between the preceding example and the current example is I gave you a basis in the first example. In this second example, I give you the subspace in a different fashion. I say it's a solution set of a linear system. And so we have to do a little bit of work to find a basis for that, for the a basis for W. All right, but then once we've got that basis, the problem of decomposing the vector 1, 2, 1 with respect to the subspace, it's going to proceed just like we did before. We now have W equals the span of the vectors minus 1, 1, 0, and minus 1, 0, 1. And in fact, these are basis vectors for W. So now we can, next step is going to be to find the perpendicular subspace. This is going to be the null space of the matrix we get by using these basis vectors as rows. So it's going to be the null space of, let's see, minus 1, 1, 0, and minus 1, 0, 1. All right, well, unfortunately, it's not quite in row echelon form, but pretty simple, I think. So this is the matrix. These are just using these basis vectors as rows, and then row reducing all the way to reduced row echelon form. Now I've got the coefficient matrix in reduced row echelon form. I can read off equations. X1 minus X3 has to equal zero. X2 minus X3 has to equal zero. What I see is both X1 and X2, corresponding to these columns with pivots, they all can be expressed in terms of X3. And in fact, you can see that it's just going to be 1, 1, 1 is going to be the basis vector. Let's see if I can do that slowly. I have 1, 0, minus 1, 0, 1, minus 1. That's the reduced row echelon form. I get equations x1 equals x3, x2 is equal x3. What I've done is I've written down the equation x1 times 1, x2 times 0, minus 1 times x3 is equal to 0. I've moved from those equations, I've moved the variable corresponding to the column without a pivot over to the right hand side. And then I write down the solution vector x3, x3, x3. And you see that it's every solution vector is a scalar multiple of this vector. So that's our basis vector. That's our basis vector for the perpendicular subspace. And we're almost done. We've got a basis for W. And I've also got a basis for the perpendicular subspace. So now I'll use this basis for R3, and I'll try to figure out the components of the vector 1, 2, 1 when I expand this vector 1, 2, 1 in terms of these three basis vectors, the columns of this form. I do a row reduction to reduce row echelon form. And what I find is I get a unique solution. X1 has to equal 2/3, X2 has to equal minus 1/3, and X3 has to equal 4/3. That means I can take the vector, where is it? 1, 2, 1, and when I expand it in terms of these three vectors, the components along the first vector is going to be 2/3, component along the second vector is going to be minus 1/3, and the component along the third vector is going to be 4/3. I take the first two terms, since they're constructed from basis vectors for W, the sum of the first two terms is going to be in W, and oops, I didn't complete this problem. That last, what was to happen on that last slide is the idea was to find constant C1, C2, and C3 so that the given vector could be expressed in terms of the basis we just found, this basis. And what we found is that C1 had to equal 2/3, that C2 has to equal minus 1/3, and the third has to equal this last component, 4/3. And so our vector D is in fact 2/3 times our first basis vector, which is minus 1, 1, 0, plus or minus the second coefficient times the second basis vector, which is minus 1, 0, 1. And then we have the fourth or the third term coefficient times the third basis vector, 1, 1, 1. Then this part is dW because it's constructed by taking linear combinations of basis vectors for W. And this part is the perpendicular component. And then that's our decomposition. You can explicitly calculate what this vector is, and then you can just scale and multiply that vector to get D perp. Okay, so that's how those calculations go. Once you find a basis for W, you need that to find a basis for W perp. But then once you have a basis for W and W perp, you get a basis for the entire vector space, and the problem becomes row reducing a given linear system to its reduced row echelon form, and then use these entries in the last column to tell you what that expansion is. And then the last step is to take this expansion and break it in two, the part that lives inside W plus the part that lives in the perpendicular subspace. Okay, so I have 8 minutes left. Let me pause here if there are any questions on this. Okay, so what I'm going to do in the last 8 minutes of today's lecture is just remind you of all the things we've used row reduction for. I think the hard part of the final exam is you'll be faced with a problem, and then you'll see about 2 inches of space left for you to do some calculation. Well, probably what you're supposed, why I leave so much space there is because you're going to have to row reduce a matrix somehow. So what I want to do today is just show you the different ways that row reduction comes in as we try to solve problems in linear algebra. Almost everything we've done can be expressed in terms of a row reduction calculation. So to do row reduction, first thing you need to know is what is a matrix in row echelon form and what is a matrix in reduced row echelon form. Row echelon form just means that the first non-zero entries in every row, those pivots occur in a downward staircase from the upper left to the lower right. So any matrix where you have a bunch of zeros and they terminate with some non-zero entry, you want these pivots to occur in a downward staircase. That's the first stage of a general row reduction. You try to get a matrix in this form by using elementary row operations to clear out entries below pivots. But then, if you're actually trying to solve a linear system, you have to go further. You have to use more elementary row operations to recast the matrix so that its pivots are all equal to one, and so that above and below pivots, you only have zeros. You're to transform a matrix into this form, usually, just using these three elementary row operations. So use this operation when you have pivots that are sort of out of order horizontally. Then you can interchange their order so that you can get a downward staircase. Use this row operation typically so that you can make pivots all equal to one. And then this is the operation you use most often. Use it in the first stage of row operation to clear out entries below pivots. And you use this operation in the final stage to clear out entries entries above pivots. So that's the what row reduction does. Its utility is, first of all, we use row reduction to solve linear systems. That's done by forming a matrix where I take the coefficient matrix and use that as the left-hand side of an augmented matrix, and we use the column vector on the right as the final column. The solving a linear system means taking the linear system, re-expressing it as an augmented matrix, and then row-reducing this augmented matrix all the way to reduced row echelon form. That's not the end of the problem, though, because once you get it in reduced row echelon form, you have to convert back to equations, and then you have to re-express those equations as corresponding to a hyperplane. But today, in my remaining 6 minutes or so, I just want to talk about the row reduction part. But I do want to point out that oftentimes these linear systems, the one we're interested in, are where on the right-hand side we have the zero vector, in which case the solution set really only depends on the matrix. We call such solution sets the null space of the corresponding coefficient matrix. But effectively, we solve equations like this exactly like we solve equations like and the more general type. A second reason for doing row reduction is that, so now we're sort of in the material that we began after the first exam. If we have a subspace expressed as a set of all possible linear combinations of a given list of vectors, and we want to find a basis for that subspace, what we do is we write the vectors as the rows of a matrix, row reduce that matrix to row echelon form, and then we grab the non-zero rows. That will give us a basis for this simple type of subspace. Subspaces can be specified in a number of ways. In particular, I give you a matrix, there are three subspaces I can attach to that. And we use row reduction to find bases for each of these three subspaces. In fact, what you can do, if you have a given matrix, you can find bases for all three subspaces by simply row reducing your matrix to its reduced row echelon form. Once you've done that, you get a basis for the row space by just looking at grabbing the non-zero rows of this reduced row echelon form. You get a basis for the column space by taking the reduced row echelon form of your given matrix, looking at where the pivots live in that row echelon form, then going back to the original matrix and grabbing the corresponding columns. And then finally, you get a basis for the null space of this matrix by calculating its reduced row echelon form and then converting back to equations and writing down the hyperplane solution and grabbing those constant vectors that are being multiplied by the free parameters. So again, it's row reduction, that's this, the essential part of the calculation. But what you have to worry about, though, is once you've done that row reduction, what you have to do with that reduced row echelon form to get the correct answer. It's going to depend on what I asked you for. So have I run out of time? I got 1 minute left. I'll just go through this quickly, and I'll cover it again on Wednesday. When we have linear transformations, we also, so functions between vector spaces that are well-behaved with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition, we use row reduction again to find bases for subspaces we attach to these functions. Turns out that the range of a linear transformation is calculated by attaching a matrix to your linear transformation and then calculating the column space of this matrix, which you'll do by using row reduction. And that the kernel of the linear transformation, the set of vectors in the domain that get sent to zero, that can also be calculated. You have to first calculate the matrix corresponding to the linear transformation, and then you have to row reduce this matrix to reduce row echelon form to figure out exactly what a basis for that space will be. We also use row reduction to calculate determinants. Here, we take a matrix, we row reduce it to a row echelon form, and then we get an expression for the determinant based on how we row reduced A to its row echelon form. The determinant of the original matrix is going to be minus one to the number of times we had to interchange rows as we row reduced. Then we have to divide out by, if we did any scalar multiplications in doing this row reduction, we're going to have to pull out those factors. And then finally, we have the determinant of the matrix in row echelon form, but that's going to be an upper triangular matrix whose determinant is just the product of its diagonal elements. And so row reduction, it can be used to calculate determinants in this fashion. And then last thing we use row reduction for is when we are looking for eigenvectors. If you want to find the basis vectors for an eigenspace, what you have to do is calculate the null space of your given matrix minus your eigenvalue times the identity matrix. So you see that row reduction calculation occurs all over the place. What's going to be critical on your final exam is to, first of all, get the right matrix, second of all, row reduce correctly, and then third, and most importantly, is to figure out what you need to do with that matrix in reduced row echelon form to get the desired answer. Okay, so I'll stop here, and I'll see you again on Wednesday.